Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to the Bible on Trial, brought to you by Spirit of Truth Ministry. The purpose of the Bible on Trial, as created by Rich Humpel, is to compare the current beliefs of Christianity to the actual words and teachings of Jesus Christ as he gave them to his own eyewitness disciples, and then discover if there are any differences. Now join the Spirit of Truth Ministry team for an eye-opening hour of investigation as we search for truth by putting the Bible on trial. Good morning, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world today. My name is Dennis Neufeld, and this is the Bible on Trial, brought to you by Spirit of Truth Ministry. Today is, I know, that's my cat. Yeah, she's looking for the treats that are up on them. Today is Friday, January, today is Friday, January 16, 2015, and we are delighted that you are all here with us today. We've been having a wonderful discussion prior to our discussion, and we will be getting to the topic of the day here in just a moment. But first, I want to direct your attention to our chat room. My name is Dennis, as I said, and I'm going to be on chat today. You can call in or chat in with your comments or questions. If you'd like to call in, boy, we would love to have you call in and let us know what you think. We're always kind, gentle, and respectful of all of the callers, the few that do take the risk and want to call in. If you'd like to call in, our phone number is 646-716-8390. And our landline toll-free number is 877-903-3193. I have two websites posted up on our chat room. The first link that you see there is spiritoftruthministry.net. That is our WordPress website, and we are growing by leaps and bounds on the WordPress site. I just posted a few days ago a wonderful article, a new one by Rick, and we highly recommend that you go take a look at that. I am working on another one as we speak, so you can go there for that information. You can also go to our original website, spiritoftruthministry.net/STM. There's lots of good information there as well. Let's have prayer, and we will see where the Spirit leads us. Father in heaven, thank you so much for granting us a peaceful time together, an hour away from the world and from the trials and the tribulations of our lives and the lives of those around us. I pray, Father, that as we study, as we search for truth, you will reveal it to us so that we can be better prepared to be of service to you and your kingdom here on this earth. Thank you, Father, for doing this in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Good morning, Suzette. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good.
Good. And there may be an auspicious day in your life today because your hubby may get his motorcycle back.
Don't jinx it.
Well, I won't jinx it.
I am not getting my hopes up.
Anyway, and across the table from me is my good friend and co-author of our book, Rick Sterling. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Dennis.
Speaking of our book, it is on the website, and you can read the entire thing in it. You can read in its entirety. We, many years ago, actually more or less decided not to do a revised version of the book because we can just add whatever we need to our WordPress website, and we're doing that on a regular basis, and we again encourage you to go there. Our other friend who is here today but not right at the microphone is Dr. Don. So, good morning, everyone. Good evening. Good afternoon. We'll turn it over to Rick. Good morning.
Those of you who have been keeping up with our study, what I have been showing is taking a little bit of time. An hour doesn't seem to be nearly enough time to complete the session that we, that we need to. I've been working through a proof to show the consistency of the information in the information that God has been pleased to share with his chosen messengers.
And apropos of this, I went back and listened to a couple of our very, very earliest broadcasts on this program, The Bible on Trial, with Dr. Rich as the host way back in 2007. Actually, I listened to one, a couple of them from September of 2007. And I will tell you, there are certain things that have not changed. And there are certain things that have materially changed, because even back in 2007, we made the statement that the Bible is the entire Word of God.
Whoa.
Okay. So things have dramatically changed since then. And
what you're saying, we don't say that now.
We don't say what, Dr. Don?
New listeners. My mom is always interested in new listeners. We don't say that anymore.
We do not say that anymore.
In fact, just a few weeks ago, I began the study with...
Are we going astray, or why is that?
Those of you who...
Oh, by the way, the dogs are yowling,
yes,
at sirens.
I know. Yeah. Which, of course, there is a plenty nowadays.
Yeah.
I said that the textbook for our study is the Bible. And the Bible is representative of a field. A field that is for the growing of crops. And that open your Bible and you will see words. Sentences, paragraphs, chapters, books, sections, and that these words, sentences, paragraphs, chapters, verses, books, they are seed. Now, there are those who consider themselves experts, proclaim themselves to be experts.
Or they have been proclaimed to be experts by their degrees and
certificates. And length of service. That say that if you're really honest with yourself, the evidence that is quite obvious when you read the Bible, when you consider where it's come from, when you realize that there's no reliable original source from which to check this Bible with, the only truthful, logical conclusion that you can come to is that the whole of the Bible cannot be taken as a first-hand source. In other words, the words that you find in there are a compilation of the ideas and teachings of various scholars throughout the ages. And so when you read the Bible, it's basically a novel, a work of fiction, a work of myth and legend that you are to remember, that it's no more real in its explanations or in its descriptions of events and so on than is Homer's Odyssey or the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Assyrian records of the gods or the Chinese records of the gods or any of that stuff. It's all just made up cultural beliefs.
Or the Hopi account of the flood.
So what I am showing, and I did last Friday, started last Friday, is I'm showing that the reliability of the material can be tested by the truthfulness of its revelation. Now, of course, events that have already taken place, which no one who was there is around to ask, that is one thing, and I understand. But the way I look at this is that if there is information about the day in which we're living that can be demonstrated as being valid, then that would increase the credibility of the whole of that material, so that you could understand that it would be reasonable to know that the information in the material is reliable. And I talked about the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, it's called a dream. It may have been a dream, but the way that Daniel not only told Nebuchadnezzar what he saw, because that was the requirement. Nebuchadnezzar knew that if he wanted the truth concerning this vision that he had, only the one who could tell him what the vision was could be relied upon to give him the truth of the information. Well, you know, and we talked about the first ones that Nebuchadnezzar asked to give him the information of his dream. They told him how ridiculous it was and how unreasonable it was for him to ask them to tell him what his vision was. Because no king had ever asked that of any of his, you know, wise men. But Nebuchadnezzar was no fool. he could not have accomplished what he accomplished if he were a fool. And so Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, you were lying there on your bed and you were thinking about the future. And this is what you saw in a vision. And draw your attention to this image and the feet of the image, because the feet of the image were a mixture of two materials, iron and baked clay. And the quality of the kingdoms at the time of the feet, some would have the strength of iron, some would be brittle like clay, like baked clay. We can see that today. Ceramic, baked, fired pottery. It has strength to hold things, but when you hit it with a rod of iron, it shatters into many pieces. One interesting thing, especially in light of the events that have happened over this last week around the world, and that is, we find in verses 43 and 44 of Daniel 2, "And just as you saw the iron and the clay of the earthenware mixed together, so the two will be mixed together in the seed of man, but they will not hold together any more than iron will blend with earthenware." And have we not seen that lately? Any of you who have watched the national news will have heard what the Muslim population of France is. It's like 19% or something like that. Don't quote me on that, but that's a reasonable percentage. All of Europe. When you look at Europe, you look at the United States, you look at the countries of the world, by and large, there are many nationalities represented in country which is foreign to their nationality. And they are a mixture, but they do not adhere to one another. And you see that.
Yeah.
They live in their own little areas, ghettos, if you will, however you want to call it. They're mixed in, but they're not mixed together. They kind of live with each other, mixed in with others. The reason I'm going through all of this is that I want you to see that back in Daniel's day, at the time of Nebuchadnezzar, it would be unheard of to say that each country would have certain nationalities living in it. But they would never see themselves as a national of the nation in which they were living. They would be more like refugees. But they live together. This is evident. And when we see this, it would be a foregone conclusion, a given. I like the word given because although I never excelled at geometry because I never took it seriously, until later on. When I was in high school, I didn't take too much too seriously, but I was able to get by. In geometry, you have givens, where you look at a geometric structure, and then you look and see what is given. Side A is twice side B. Side C is the square root of side A times side B, whatever. It's this when you have a given, I remember on a test, here was a isosceles triangle. And the test question was, prove that this is a triangle, an isosceles triangle. And I said, look at it.
Makes sense.
You know, why do you need to prove that it is when all you have to do is look at it and you can tell? Well, of course, they wanted this angle added to this angle equals that angle. You know, I mean, the givens. So what I'm saying is, here in Daniel, the prophecy has certain givens. And you look at those givens, and then you take those givens and you go, whoa, here it is, right here. Angle A plus angle B equals angle C. So therefore, it is an isosceles triangle. So this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, now understand that the experts say this was all written in the 3rd, 4th century BCE, occupied by Israel and Jerusalem was occupied by the Greeks, and it was part of the Seleucid Empire. One of the generals of Alexander the Great, one of the four generals, which incidentally is in another vision prophecy that Daniel had in chapter 8. So, did you want to say something?
I was just thinking, having taught physical science and all that, the descriptor for an isosceles triangle is that the base angles are equal, and at least two angles are equal. They're the base angles. You can actually have three. If all three of those angles are the same, it's still an isosceles triangle. So it can be a flat or a narrow, but the base angles are always the same. It just hit me, going, gosh, I know that.
Yeah, you remember that. And the hypotenuse. I know the square of the hypotenuse. Yeah, there are a few things I remember, but of course at the time I never bothered to memorize it, which I've actually always been very gifted at, but it never interested me.
What did the experts say about Daniel?
Well, the experts have said that, well, like I said, that it was all written back in the time of the Greek occupation of Israel. You know, scribes had nothing better to do than to make up stories that contained prophecies that would tend to make the Jews look like God really was giving them information. It would be impressive. Well, you know, it is very impressive because it's very accurate. So this image, the feet are the end of time. Because in the days of those kings, it says right here in the prophecy, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. It will never be given to another people. And you scratch your head. I scratch my head, and not because it itches. Because I have always been told, and believe me, in very certain terms, I have always been told that God gave the kingdom to Israel and God will never take it away. And they'll quote the text, as long as the waves are, you know, as long as the moon shines, as long as the waves beat against the shore, you will be a people before me. You are the apple of my eye. There's all these texts, but what they conveniently do is like what they do with Paul. Now, do you know what they do with Paul?
They make excuses.
Well, they make excuses, but they stop at a certain place where if they read on, their charade would be in their face. But so it's like, you know, Paul said he had a thorn in the flesh. Oh, poor Paul. You know what that thorn in his flesh was?
Oh, no, yeah,
he was
bad
half
eyesight.
Blind. He had bad eyesight. Do you know why he had bad eyesight?
Because he spent so much time making tents and sewing.
No, that's not what they said. It was that bright light. That bright light hit him, blinded him. He was blind for 3 days. Couldn't see a thing. I defy anybody to show me where God has called a prophet and blinded them so they were blind for any number of days afterwards. I defy you to show me anyone.
There was never a prophet called by God that was coerced to become a prophet.
That was slapped with blindness, so they had to go to another prophet so they'd be able to see. No, Paul has a thorn in the flesh. It's poor eyesight. Look in that other letter. He says, see what big letters I'm writing to you? Why does he have to point it out? See, they're saying, well, he had poor eyesight, so he had to write in big letters because he couldn't see the small letters. I said, did it ever occur to you that he's writing in big letters because he is pissed off? He's saying, what are you guys following those other guys for? What was I not enough? Did I not give you enough?
Did I not fulfill the...
Look at how I'm writing in these big, huge, capital, bold letters. If you could only be here, boy, you'd catch it. That's what he's saying.
Did
not
I
because
not fulfill the cup of suffering that Jesus didn't quite fulfill?
Paul's the humble guy.
Oh, my goodness.
Paul is the, you know, he, oh, you know, I love, 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 love.
Yeah, he loved himself.
But you know, those guys that come with their knife and they want to cut off your foreskin, have them cut the whole thing off. That's what he says. I'm not making this up. He says that they should do it to themselves. And if the knife slips, I'll cut the whole thing off. Oh, yes, indeed. Or you say, if you think you need to have your foreskin cut off, you're severing yourself from Christ, because when your foreskin leaves, so does he.
Oh, my goodness.
Look it up, people. It is there. And so, yes, this is a very sore subject.
Sore, yeah.
Please don't get me started, okay?
Dear.
That just came to me.
You're good.
No Jewish scribe living in Israel in 300 BCE would be able to accurately describe the situation that is described at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's vision. And no Jewish scribe would ever suggest that possibly God would even entertain a thought of taking the kingdom away from Israel. Well, I've had people say, well, he's just reinforcing that. You know, when it says that God will not, that the kingdom will not pass into the hands of another race. Oh, he's confirming the irrevocable promise that he made to Abraham.
And last week, you mentioned the statement of Jesus confirms exactly what you have been talking about in at the end of chapter 2 of Daniel, where Jesus said, because you have not fulfilled what I needed you to do, built the house so that I could be the capstone, now I am the cornerstone of a new kingdom, and that kingdom is going to be taken away from you and given to that people. That is what made the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin mad enough, angry enough to go forward with their plan to put Jesus on the cross.
Well, of course, because, you know, as Jesus was very good at doing, he could catch them at their little game. You know, he presented a case. It was a lawful presentation. He could have been standing in a courtroom and doing. He said, here is the case. This is the evidence. Now you tell me, what should the verdict be? And the guilty parties pronounce judgment upon themselves. How they did? All of a sudden they realized what they did, and their hands came slapping over their mouth. Whoa! Whoa. Oops. Oh, you dirty, rotten snake in the grass. How dare you do that to us? I mean, I'm sure that's what they're all thinking. They all wanted to kill him. He caught them. He was the same one where they came. I know what you're going to say, you little man. But look at here. Here's a coin. Tell me, do I need to pay tax to Caesar on this coin? Because, you know, I only pay my taxes to God. God says, you don't go supporting the politico establishment. So tell us, should we pay taxes? Son of God says, do you have a coin? Okay, I've got a coin. A lot of them here. Let me give you one. Whose picture is on this coin? Well, Caesar's. Well, then it doesn't belong to God, does it? So you render to Caesar what is his. I mean, if it's his, then it's his. It's not God's.
If you keep it, you're stealing.
Oh, that shut their mouths. But it didn't sway their determination any.
And at the end, when they were speaking to Pilate, they declared, we have no king but Caesar.
So you see how they only...
Whatever's useful is what they
That's
will
right.
use.
Yeah.
And so the Son of God, unbeknownst to them, had them pronounce judgment upon themselves. And what was the judgment they pronounced on themselves? We read this last week.
Death.
Not death. No, they said that the owner of that vineyard should take it away from those criminals. Take it away and give it to others who will accomplish the work. And the Son of God goes, oh, that's exactly what he's going to do. And all of a sudden they go, whoops, oh man, he's talking about us.
And those people who did that would be cast out into outer darkness.
Mm. Please tell me how scribes living in occupied Israel would be able to make that up. What I mean by that is that this statement that it will not pass into the hands of another race. And those who say, well, that's a given. God promised. They're just stating the obvious. I've talked to people about what the Son of God said to those know-it-alls when he gave them the account of the workers of the vineyard. That it says, So the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people who will do the work, and they will accomplish it. Ooh, but he wasn't talking about the Jews. He was just talking to those no good scribes and Pharisees. He was taking it away from them. He wasn't taking it away from the Jews. It amazes me the lengths that some will go to try and maintain their flimsy beliefs because they don't want to believe the truth. How could Nebuchadnezzar see accurately what would happen at the end of time? And how could Daniel, living in Nebuchadnezzar's day, be able to tell Nebuchadnezzar his vision, have it be accurate, so that we living here 3,000 years later can look at Daniel 2, 43 and 44 and go, wow, that is happening today. And we can look back at Matthew chapter 21, where this account of the workers in the vineyard, the wicked servants, are given the account that you find in Isaiah chapter 5, and you see the Son of God saying, this is the situation. What should the owner of the vineyard do? Have the guilty parties pronounce judgment on themselves? Have the kingdom taken away from them? And know for certain that whoever is given that kingdom is going to accomplish the requirements. And so we turn to Matthew. Again, this is in Matthew. Now, I'll tell you, you'll find out there that there's all kinds of doubt expressed about whether Matthew wrote Matthew. Well, doubt away. That's fine. The thing is, can Matthew be shown to be accurate?
See, whoever wrote it heard it. Whoever wrote Matthew, whether it was Matthew or someone else, was there to hear what Jesus said.
And how do we know that? Because we see it being fulfilled today. And when I say fulfilled, we don't have to stretch. It's not like everybody, this prophecy is fulfilled over here. And then the same prophecy is fulfilled over here. Every day there's a fulfillment of prophecy. And it doesn't matter whether there's a prophecy, and I'm saying this is what the prophetic expositors are saying. Any one prophecy in the Bible, I have heard people say it's been fulfilled here and fulfilled there and fulfilled over there, and it was fulfilled last week, and it'll be fulfilled next week. And what on earth good does prophecy do if the same prophecy is fulfilled daily? Matthew chapter 17, coming down from the Mount of Transfiguration. Well, of course, the experts say it never happened. First of all, how could two dead guys come back from the dead and appear? And how would the disciples who were there, the three disciples, know that it was the two dead guys? And they heard the voice of God say, this is my son, listen to him. And then his son says what? What did his son say? Verse 9, Matthew chapter 17. As they came down from the mountain, Jesus gave them this order. He didn't say, hey guys, I would appreciate it if.
It was a command.
Yeah, it was.
In the command voice, by the way.
Tell no one about the vision until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. So, what does that mean?
Don't tell anybody.
They had no clue about this risen from the dead.
He didn't want them going down there and telling the other guys, guess what we saw?
Yeah.
Guess what happened? Guess what we heard?
Mm-hmm.
Go to the people in the next town. Whoa! Listen to me. This guy is who he says he is. Why? Because we heard the voice of God and he called him his son. What did their master say? Tell no one. So what do you think they did? They obeyed. So, whoever's writing this is writing it after the Son of Man has gone back to his Father. That's when it's to be written. Matthew was not a daily diary, and that's what I want you to understand. Matthew wasn't, Mark wasn't, John wasn't, and Luke is not even, you know, worth consideration. Luke
well,
wasn't even
it,
there.
It is by comparison, though.
Well,
it is
yeah,
for
you can compare, but...
It's for comparative purposes, because, again, if you compare Matthew, Mark, and John with Luke in a variety, any number of areas, you will see absolutely demarked differences.
Yes. Some people think that the first gospel to be written is the most reliable. Because
he
was closer to the source. Well,
our associate pastor at church said that to you, and he has a Doctor of Divinity degree.
Yeah. All of these guys that questioned Jesus had their doctorate degree in whatever it was, demonicy, I think, or whatever they were. They were the experts in that. Tell no one. Now, the disciples had a question. It had been nagging at them the whole time because the religious experts had told them, you know, you guys, you don't look like fools, but you don't know what we know. You don't have our degree. These are things we spend our lives at. You guys, what do? Fish. Okay.
And you guys haven't been issued the secret handshake and the secret passwords.
What you don't seem to understand, guys, you know, and just, you know, we don't mean anything by this. But in order for the Messiah to be verified, God has given us this information that the prophet Elijah needs to show up first. And because the prophet Elijah has not shown up, this man you're following cannot be the Messiah. Now, they had their own whole prophetic... They're so much like those today, the religious experts today who look at a prophecy and go, that all happened in the past.
Yeah, that's history.
Or that all's going to happen in the future, but there certainly isn't anything going to happen now.
The term preterist comes to mind.
And we should know.
That's right.
We've been to school. Something about the blind leading the blind. They both fall in the pit or something.
I thought that was blonde leading the blonde.
Hey, wait a minute.
My sister's a blonde, and she does great blonde jokes.
So the disciples had just seen the prophet Elijah. You know, there's really nothing like an in-your-face fulfillment that has a tendency to remove all doubt. So they had just seen the prophet Elijah. So they finally had the courage to ask. And the disciples put this question to him. Why did the scribes say that Elijah has to come first? So does Jesus go into a whole dissertation? Well, you know, back then, and I go through this, and you know now, and then, you know, you guys, why are you always questioning me? What do I have to do to get you to believe? No, he doesn't do that. He doesn't talk down to them. He says, true. Elijah is to come. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. Now, here's another question. Let's say, you know, Matthew did write this. First of all, Matthew wasn't on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right. Therefore, he must have, pointed out before, he must have gotten his information from the disciples who were there after the resurrection.
He had gone back to his father. So, why would someone trying to promote Son of God, who is the Messiah, he's trying to promote him and make him believable, so he wrote this book called Matthew to show that Jesus was the Messiah. And here is the perfect setup. The religious experts missed the fulfillment of the prophecy about the coming of Elijah. They missed it. That puts them totally out of the picture. What they said about Jesus, that he didn't qualify because the prophet Elijah didn't come first, this explains it was their own fault. They missed it. And that would be reason enough. But why would someone trying to show that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, he was the Messiah, why would they have him first answer this question, Elijah is coming? Wait a minute now, he's got his prophecy sequence wrong. The Messiah doesn't precede Elijah. The Messiah comes after the prophet Elijah because the prophet Elijah has to make things straight before he shows up. Who would even think to change the sequence of events? Maybe the one who gave the prophecy in the first place, and who knows that it is not going to work out according to their expectations. Why? Because they didn't meet the requirements. Requirements? What requirements? I didn't think there were any requirements. All they were to be was born a Jew. If you were born a Jew, you met the requirements. But in Daniel 9, the whole list of requirements are there. And it's very obvious that the most important requirement was they had to have everlasting righteousness. They had to be righteous, and obviously because they keep questioning him, they don't even know righteousness, because why? He is the righteous king. So they hadn't met the requirements, so what? There's an Elijah coming who will ensure that the requirements are met. And it says, he says it right here. He says, Elijah is to come to see that everything is once more as it should be. To see that everything is once more as it should be. Now, what does that mean? Well, that's the way the translators have translated it in the Jerusalem Bible. In the New American Standard Bible, it says, and will restore all things. Mm-hmm. What is it that God is working towards? What is the ultimate end of his labor?
Restoration.
Of what?
Build a kingdom.
Of what?
Righteousness.
Righteousness of his glory. Mm-hmm. In fact, what we hear, everybody that...
Numbers 14,
everybody, 20. Unless they've been living under a rock, knows that what God is going to do is he is going to create the earth anew. He's not going to make the planet new, but everything on it. He is going to... Why? Because the earth is going to be a wilderness. It is going to be void of all life, just like it was in the beginning.
Numbers what?
14:21.
He is going to create a new heaven and a new earth. It says that in Revelation. And how is he going to accomplish that? Because, I mean, if he was just going, if that's what his whole thing was, then he could just come down here and do it now, right? The problem is that if he were to come down and do it now, or if he would have come down and done it before now, he needs to cleanse the earth of all corruption. Mm-hmm. And do you know how he does that? It's called the lake of fire. What does the lake of fire consume?
Everything.
Yeah. And every one who has corruption.
Right.
Sin is corruption. So all those who have sin in them will be
toast,
burnt up. That's why he has not come yet. Because if he were to come, he's coming to cleanse. He's coming to take those who are clean, and he's going to cleanse the earth of all those who are not clean. So what did the devil do? You know, the devil came across, he has a brilliant plan. Because he knows a thing or two about God. He knows that when God comes, he's coming to cleanse the earth of all evil. He knows that. He's the one who started it all. And he knows that all of those who have the impurity in them of sin, evil, however you want to call it, God is not going to take them to the heavens. He is going to destroy them with all the corrupt on the earth. So why does the earth need a prophet Elijah or a type, Elijah type? Well, why did they need it first? I mean, when you read here, you see how this cannot be made up. Because Jesus goes on to say, I tell you that Elijah has come already. Okay, now that, you have to stop and ask this question. First he says Elijah is to come. Now he says Elijah came already. How many fulfillments of this prophecy are there going to be? Well, it is true that he says the one that is to come will accomplish. So obviously there's coming one and he will accomplish. But he says there's one that's already come. They did not recognize him, but treated him as they pleased. And the Son of Man will suffer similarly at their hands. The disciples understood then that he'd been speaking of John the Baptist. Now see, there's a lot of problems in here for those who would say that this was all made up and it was made up by somebody who was trying to promote an agenda. Well, what agenda would they be trying to promote? You have to have a reason if you're trying to deceive. Immediately when he said Elijah has come already, the disciples understood that he was speaking to John the Baptist. Well, why didn't they just say that in the first place instead of saying, I mean, if this was made up, why didn't they just say, well, guys, come on, John the Baptist, they missed him. Well, wouldn't that put them in a better light? Because they'd all been wondering who this guy is. He's pretty good. He does all these miracles. He teaches all these really incredible things.
Most people, when they are speaking, are not quite that self-effacing. Everyone wants to look better in the eyes of their friends and their neighbor and their families. So they will shade things toward their own benefit. And we don't see that here in Matthew. We don't see Matthew pulling punches to alleviate himself from any misconception. You know, he's not suggesting that he did not have misconceptions. See what I mean? He is saying, I didn't understand this in the language that he's giving. It's amazing. Most people would not do that. Most people who are writing after the fact would not admit their faults like this.
Yeah, and here's the thing. What are they, if they're making this up, what are they saying? The man that we followed, the Son of Man, who we know was the Messiah, could not accomplish what was required. He could not establish the kingdom. He couldn't do it. It has to be done by somebody else. There's some down the line, and then it will happen. But he couldn't do it. See, this doesn't fly.
This is the Son of God, and he can do anything he wants.
Yeah,
except.
He can raise the dead, but he cannot bring the kingdom.
Yeah, except have people choose him when they don't want to.
Yeah. And so we see in this event that there is a future where there will be one who will come, who will start the work and who will complete the work and who will meet the requirements, and it will happen. The kingdom will come. At the time of the feet, iron and baked clay, at that time the God of heaven will establish a kingdom which will never be destroyed. It will not be given to another people, and this is completely consistent with what it says here in Matthew 17, 9 through 13, that the kingdom is coming. It did not come when the Son of God was here. He laid the foundation. He's the cornerstone. It is there. And all the way down at the end, the time of the feet, a stone separates itself from the quarry and is laid alongside that cornerstone. And it is in 100% alignment with the cornerstone, the Son of God, the one who showed up 2,000 years ago, and he is about to accomplish his word in the very, very near future. We are looking at a very short amount of time. You say, well, where is the prophet Elijah? Because he said the prophet Elijah would show up. Well, hopefully it won't be like the scribes and the Pharisees, that when Elijah shows up, they fail to recognize him because he's not saying anything they recognize at all. They control the information that is coming out of religion, and they will not recognize Elijah when he comes.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you all for listening. We encourage you to join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. Pacific time for another edition of The Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling. So on behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis Neufeld saying thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow. So long for now.